Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man who is sporting a man bun in tribute to Gareth Bale. It's Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Caught in 4K.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you covering a ball patch as well, Nathan?
Yeah, of course. I heard psychic for the first time there. I'm coming round to people mishearing psychic in the introduction. I heard it that time, yeah.
Oh no. Yeah, normally I had started really pronouncing the D in psychic. Because I became very self-aware. But yes, I need to start doing that again, don't I?
Give Bardi the hard D at the beginning of the episode.
Nicely done. There's so much to talk about. I'm really excited. I'm in a good place today. Starting with our newsletter, Bardi.
Yeah, before we get to that, I was pondering going back before we started recording today and listening to the podcast we did after we beat, last time we beat Sheffield United, and just seeing how things were then, and then just seeing how we compare it to your comments now we've beaten Sheffield United again, and just to see if there's anything that correlates between the two. That I got very excited after we beat Sheffield United. I think you two were quite excited after we beat Sheffield United, whereas this time I'm a bit like, but we just beat Sheffield United. But I guess we'll get into that. Anyway, newsletter plug before I start putting a big downer on things. Yeah, the newsletter went out yesterday. I think it was the most interesting one we've done so far because, as I said in the intro, I had this penciled in as the big trophy month where we could celebrate our manager bringing home a cup. But that obviously didn't happen, and instead we ended up killing another manager. And then I just thought about all the managers in the past that Tottenham have buried and how now, with time having passed, do we see their reigns? Was there something in what they did while they were in charge of the club that is got a redeeming feature? Because no one likes to speak ill of the dead. So was there anything in Andre Villas-Boas, Christian Gross, Harry Redknapp's time with the club that deserves memory that when they were fired, we kind of forgot about, but now with time having passed, perhaps there was something interesting in what they did and how they served the club. So I really found it interesting, and I hope the subscribers did.
A nice one, yeah. I mean, it's excellent stuff as ever. Four guest writers, because we have a piece about Oliver Skipp as well, which was very enjoyable. Three guest writers writing about former managers who have very different styles and approaches to their writing, they meshed really nicely. I liked your piece too, Bardi. It was all just, yeah, lovely stuff. Well done.
Thank you, boss.
I like it when you show me the respect that I deserve. And Nathan, you've been busy as well.
Yeah, I've been really, really, really busy on highly, highly demanded content. An hour-long investigative documentary on a manager who we recently turned down. I've defended myself twice now on the Q&A poll on Friday, on the beginning of the video, but I don't think, you know, the possibility of him ever coming to Spurs is dead in the water. I think that it's you know, he's still a good manager who's still out there at a lower level than the position of our club. So if we come back to it in a few weeks, or if we come back to it in a few years, I still think that video will have some value. So You know, it's out there. It's done. To be honest, it's probably like my best work.
Oh, bless you, mate. Bless you. So for anyone who's wondering, this is Erik ten Hag that you've researched and created a video about. And I've not watched it yet. I'm looking forward to it very much. But yeah, I mean, from my reading and from everything I'd watched about him over the past week, he looked really good. There was lots to admire, lots to like, but it sounds as though Spurs have walked away potentially from this, and as a result, Ajax have triggered a 1-year extension, which was written to his previous contract. But as you say, this doesn't mean it's necessarily the end.
Or Spurs have walked away because we knew that Ajax were going to trigger an extension and change the compensation. I think that's quite a plausible explanation of events.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Maybe Ajax were asking for an unreasonable amount of money, and Levy thinks he can get a better deal elsewhere. Yeah, that figures too. So let's get into it. Let's get into the Sheffield United match. I'm excited. I mean, it's silly to get carried away because it's Sheffield United. They are absolute trash. One of the worst teams the Premier League's seen, certainly in recent years. But it's also fun to get carried away.
Yeah.
So let's balance the two things. The team selection was really interesting and exciting from my perspective because Dele was back in the team. His first start in like 6 weeks. I think he last started against Dinamo Zagreb. And his first league start in God knows how long. I haven't actually checked that, but I imagine a lot longer. Gareth Bale was also back in the team. And Ndombele was not, though, and that is slightly concerning. Bardi, were you surprised that Dele was in, but Ndombele was on the bench?
I'm not surprised that Dele got a start. I think it's only kind of right we have a look at him, and Sheffield United is a very low-risk opposition, so it's good to give him a go. And I kind of like Mason's words about Dele having trained well all week and put in a good effort, so he kind of put to bed the kind of rumour that Dele doesn't do anything in the training ground. He just runs around talking about baked beans and stuff. So it was good to have him back. The Ndombele thing, it continues to be a concern, but I mean, he obviously sees that he doesn't work as a double pivot with Højbjerg, and he prefers Lo Celso alongside him. And if that's what he prefers, then I guess that's what we're going to keep seeing. It is a bit of a concern that I said last week that this is the third manager we've had that leaves him out and continues to sacrifice him. I don't know what his future will be at Tottenham. Perhaps he'll end up being this fantastic player. I'm not denying Ndombele is a brilliant player, but perhaps he's just not suited for England and the Premier League. And it's happened to many, many good players that they just haven't settled here. And then they've gone to Spain or somewhere else and had a great career. But yeah, it does worry me a little bit that Ndombele is kind of being frozen out at the moment.
Nathan, is there anything in the styles of the two players that would mean Lo Celso is better suited to the approach Ryan Mason's taken so far at playing in the double pivot?
Maybe in a very sort of short-term view of like back to basics, simplistic football, rather than Ndombele, who is sort of so dynamic that he can throw. And I remember when he was first breaking into the team some time ago, that his sort of his dynamism, his directness, his sort of turn of pace and direction could throw not just the opposition off, which is the intention, but also Spurs players, and the ball would be pinged into their feet when they were like tracking back in a different direction. But I still think that his overall quality sort of should shine through despite that. Maybe him missing out a couple of games early on, as Spurs established himself, isn't you know, a nightmare. But I think definitely going forward, I really want to see him. I mean, I'm not worried because obviously Mason isn't likely to be our manager next season. So it's not like we have to sort of start freaking out about things. It's just a little disappointing because everything is so good and everything is so right now. Okay, we lost to City, but everyone loses to City. We're playing good football. We're bringing in all of these previously ostracized players, but Ndombele is missing out. And there's an extent, obviously, to which like you can only play four of Bale, Lo Celso, Dele, Son, and Ndombele. But like Ndombele isn't just like the one coming off the bench. He's sort of like completely missing. So it's slightly disappointing, but it doesn't put a dampener on the overall, or much of a dampener on the overall goodness that is Ryan Mason's Tottenham Hotspur Football Club.
I think there's no chance that Ndombele is carrying a knock and that we can excuse it in that way, because Mason had every opportunity to clear that up post cup final when he didn't mention anything. Could you argue that Mason is doing this because we've sort of seen enough of Ndombele? We know what Ndombele is. We know he's really good. And going into, like, finishing out the season and going into next season, he's just sort of giving us, or giving the coaching staff, giving the club, giving the fans an opportunity to have a look at Lo Celso in the pivot, because Lo Celso has not been around so much this season due to injury. Is there anything in that, or is that...
I don't think so.
No.
There's an Ali Gold article out this morning that sort of very softly implies that his performance against Southampton was perceived fairly negatively, and so that's okay. Why he's out of the team. But I think the focus of that section of the article is that everything's happy, everything's great, and Ndombele is keen to prove himself, and the mood is good, and there's no hard feelings.
Cool.
So he's got several games to work his way back into the team, or at least, you know, rotation of things. I'm not too worried.
Yeah. I think Ryan Mason has nothing to lose, but he has a hell of a lot to gain. Mm-hmm. If he comes out of this end of season run with, say he gets a 100% league win record, then I imagine that conversation he has with Sherwood. But if he comes away with five wins, then all of a sudden he sets himself up as a possible manager for another maybe championship club, or perhaps even a lower level Premier League club. So I think Ryan Mason cares about the football club, but I also think he cares about his career. So he wouldn't be given Lo Celso minutes if it was like, he's given Lo Celso minutes to benefit himself and benefit Tottenham Hotspur. It's not to just literally give Lo Celso minutes so we can find out a bit more about him. He wants to win football matches, and what he sees at the moment is Lo Celso is a better option than Ndombele. I don't think there's any kind of future thinking in dropping Ndombele.
And let's not get it wrong, you know, Lo Celso is a very good, very good player who I personally believe is massively underrated by our fans currently. I think his upside is enormous. I'm excited about what he can do next year with a new manager who values his skill set a bit more. I really like him in the middle. I always have. We've spoken about him being versatile and being able to play from the right, but I much prefer him in the middle personally. I like him being on the ball more. I like the fact that he doesn't always like try and force a pass. He's very happy to just lay back to the centre-backs. That's not a problem for him. He doesn't like always have to go forward, where I think Ndombele sometimes does try and force things a bit too much. And perhaps, as Nathan sort of alluded to, perhaps that's one of the reasons that Mason's gone Lo Celso for the time being. But, I mean, we focused on the negative there, but there was a lot to be excited about in the team selection otherwise. Bale being back, obviously. I absolutely would have started Bale in the cup final. I understand why you perhaps want a more defensive winger and if you go for that approach, but I just think Bale's someone who can score a goal from nothing. We don't have enough of those players. So I was very happy to see him back. And Dele, I mean... Yeah, I just looked while you were talking, Nathan, and actually Dele's last league start was the match before Dinamo against Fulham. So, like, yeah, 6-7 weeks ago in the league as well.
But that's not the full picture, is it? We've hardly seen Dele this year, you know?
It's not the full picture in the slightest. I mean, he's basically been excluded from the league squad for a full season. In the prime of his career, he's 25 now. So it's a problem. It was a problem. And Levy obviously felt it's a problem, didn't want to move Dele on because... it was the wrong time to sell. His value was low.
Yeah.
But it's more than that. You know, Dele's a really bloody good footballer. And just having him back, I felt really excited. I like his new hair too.
Yeah,
that
too.
Helps.
Yeah.
It really suits him. He just looks so upbeat. And it's just nice to see him looking happy again.
Yeah.
So let's get into it. Let's talk about the match and how you think it went. And what I would say is that the first few minutes were a bit cautious. There wasn't like a lot of thrust there. But what I saw in the first few minutes was lots of movement in the front line, which continued throughout the whole match. So you'd have Kane dropping deep into pockets, as he always does. I mean, that's just classic Harry Kane. Son making a lot more runs than I've seen him make recently. And Bale as well, looking for movement in behind the defence. And then Dele, as he always has done, as he always will do, just drifting between players, drifting into the hole, drifting into midfield and creating overloads before then bursting beyond the defence as well. And that was really encouraging. And what that meant is, whilst we were playing cautiously at the start, when we changed it up and started playing a little bit more directly with a little bit more zip, the movement patterns were already established. And we were able to sort of start to create, not necessarily chances, because I didn't think our chance creation was great in the first half, but we were able to create patterns of play, which I just hadn't seen for months and months. And it felt really nice to see some attacking patterns, some rhythm, players getting touches. Yeah, I mean, I just felt good about the attacking performance. Nathan, let's start with you. What difference did Denny make, firstly, but also generally, what did you see?
I saw some football that was nice to watch. I agree it took a little while to warm up, but I thought that like pretty much straight from the off, there was some nice combinations and there was some possession with intent rather than just sort of passing it around the back. And yeah, there were some nice movements. It wasn't hugely fruitful right from the beginning. It took a little while to get going. When it did, it was really good, and I think that we sort of had to find ourselves and prove to ourselves our own capability, and we grew into it, grew into the confidence, and started getting things going. And my goodness, how like much that means to me as a fan. You know, nothing has made anything clearer than the last 2 months. That like, yeah, man, I will make absolutely no apology that I want to enjoy watching my football club, because, okay, football is community and sport and everything else, but before really anything, football is entertainment, right? Football is what you're putting on the TV instead of getting invested in a show that writes itself into a corner and then you're disappointed in how it ends. So, if I'm putting, I liked watching it. I watched it. I was able to watch it the whole time. It was aesthetically pleasing, and that just matters. It just does matter. Yeah. And I will take no more little side notes on why that's only one aspect. I really like watching my team play good football that's good to watch, and that's what we got. And it's such a relief. It's such a joy. I loved it.
Barney, how about you? Gareth Bale on absolutely top form, albeit against Muck, but he looks kind of irresistible.
I mean, he was surgical with his finishing. The first one was brilliant. The second one I think was my favourite, because it was only when you really saw it from the other angle how he finished it off. You know, Gareth Bale was a masterful player. Whether he should have started the League Cup final, I don't know. I still don't know whether he has enough to warrant a place in a team that needs to work across the pitch. But he's an incredible player, and he's going to score goals, especially against Muck. And I'm with you guys. It's nice to see Tottenham playing. It's so easy for us to say playing with freedom and taking the handbrake off. These are cliches that we use, but it is really nice to see. And of course, it makes the game far more interesting to watch. And ultimately, football is about entertainment, and it is more entertaining to watch Tottenham play like this. I think Aurier needs. We need to chat about Aurier, because
he
had quite the game, and he was used more often than Reguilón. We would purposely give the ball to Aurier, and he popped up with another two assists. This guy must do amazing stats that we just ignored. Last season he had loads of them. This year he's popping up with a few. So yeah, I still don't think he's a very good player, but you can see why managers keep turning to him, because he does have something. Unfortunately, he just is unable to harness it all the time. But yeah, he that first pass for Bale's goal was great, and then obviously the other one was a bit of a Tom Carroll assist. But still, he had a good game, and we do go after him when he's bad.
That's true.
So we do deserve to praise him when he's good.
He was very, very, very good. The pass was fantastic for the first goal. I actually thought his defending was really good as well. Not that they asked a lot of him, but when they did ask things of him, he not only answered them, but he normally like came away carrying the ball out of defence, that's pretty impressive to be able to sort of defend and then turn it into an attack. Yeah, Aurier was truly excellent in this game, I thought. But you mentioned taking the handbrake off and playing with freedom. I'm going to go a step further than that. I don't think it was freedom or taking the handbrake off. I think it was just a totally different approach. I think there was the same number of sort of restrictions, but they were just tweaked in such a significant way that we weren't defending as our first priority. We were attacking as our first priority. We were pressing, aggressively pressing in Sheffield United's, in the middle third certainly, and also in Sheffield United's third as a first priority. So there were some sort of restrictions still. You know, players had to be in certain areas, but it was just flipped on its head, and we were doing it on the front foot. And it's so much more joyful as a fan to watch that. You feel less concerned, because the sort of the potential for an error happens in the opposition's half rather than in your box. I really found it refreshing, to be honest.
Yeah, I do. Of course, it is refreshing. I don't think like Tottenham are fixed, and this was the reason why we weren't playing great. But I'm happy to see it. I do have concerns about Dele, but then of course he hasn't played much football, and I'm just worried about him in this kind of number 10 role. I think right now he's better with his back to goal than Ndombele, which is perhaps why he's being played there at that moment, because Mason doesn't want Højbjerg and Ndombele alongside each other anymore. And I think Dele in that position works. I think he works better than Lucas with his back to goal as well. Lucas is pretty good when you wind him up and just let him run at things. So I would like to see this kind of Dele project continue for the rest of the season. I want to see him start every single game, and then we can kind of judge from there. Because I think at the moment, we all know he's a good player, but we're still judging him on stuff that he did maybe 2 years ago. And I know there's mitigating factors around that, but I want to see something from Dele now, which puts a statement out, which from him, which proves to our next manager that he deserves to be a player that you can build a team around, and not just kind of myth of a player that we keep referencing from many years ago that he's no longer.
I want to come back to this because we've got several questions on Dele, and it'd be good to do a bit of a deep dive. But just to say, I really want to see Dele play with Ndombele. It's something we haven't seen a great deal of, and I think their skill sets will mesh beautifully. You know, Ndombele, who is able to like pick a pass really, like he's got exceptional vision for spotting a pass early, a bit like Christian Eriksen had. Ndombele's got that in spades, and Dele, who's so good at finding space, that feels to me like a match made in heaven. So I'm really hoping we get to see a little bit of that before the season's out. Nathan, anything else you want to add around the tactics in this game before we move on?
No, since we launched the Patreon, people have been saying, can you do specific match analysis? And I've kind of been leaving it unsaid, but basically there wasn't that much to say a lot of the time with Mourinho. And then we had our first game under Ryan Mason, and we got Harry B on. It was Harry B's idea, but we did a match analysis with him, and similarly, but from a more positive angle, there isn't that much to say about the game under Ryan Mason so far. We're playing sort of day one proactive football, right? We're playing here are how you make a triangle, and remember
100%.
Yeah, and here's how to you know make sure you press the opposition early. And there isn't a great level of intricacy or detail in that. And yet, of course, it's Sheffield United, and they are really, really bad. You mentioned the last time we played Sheffield United, the podcast recorded after that. I very specifically remember downplaying the idea that it's just Sheffield United after that, so I get to cash in on that now. And say, well, if you go back to that game, like we beat them 3-1, right? And I
was that the Ndombele goal, the outrageous lob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was that game.
There you go. So there were nice moments in that game, and we beat them 3-1. And I remember the point of focus at the time is that we continued to attack the opposition. We continued to possess the ball throughout the full game, and we managed to do that against Sheffield United. But this is really a level above that, right? We're not just like demonstrating that we can do that. We're not just saying, here's us having the ball. It was more expressive. It was recognizing that, yes, it's just Sheffield United, and using that as an opportunity to be expressive and have fun. And I have missed having fun a lot.
It's a good point. I massively agree with the point you're making about creating triangles, especially through the midfield. Dele playing like a hybrid 8-10 really helps with that. He would often drop in and create the tip of a triangle or a rhombus, if you want to go one step further. And that really helped us progress the ball. And that was incredibly useful. The Celso also really excellent at creating angles in midfield to move the ball forward. Let's dig into Dele a bit, because we've been sitting on some Dele questions for quite a while now, to be honest. We've been sitting on quite a lot of questions generally, because there's been so many talking points, and we've got like a backlog, but the Dele stuff's interesting. So let me run through three questions, and then we'll just talk about them more generally. Mark Lynch asked us to do a proper look at Dele over the last few years. Personally, while we like to blame Mourinho, I think his performances and effectiveness had dropped well before he came in. At what point is his future looked at by the club? Jonah Shipley said, I know there's been a very warranted vocal frustration at how Dele has been handled this season on the extra inch, with him nearly leaving in January and his somewhat public frictions with Mourinho. I have tended to agree. However, I'm starting to think that he hasn't actually done enough to warrant a starting place in our squad. Nick Kurzweil says, I was having a conversation with a United supporting mate of mine, and he was comparing Dele to Bruno in terms of their instinctive maverick playing styles. Both players will still misplace a lot of passes and have games where 90% of what they try to do doesn't quite come off, but they try and try to create so much they're still valuable game changers. The difference, according to my mate, is that Bruno has that feral edge to him, a proper wild streak and a relentless drive that rubs off on his teammates and can really aggravate opponents. He wondered if Dele maybe lacked that, and I immediately thought back to the Dele of old, who definitely had that feral edge, and did Poch maybe coach that out of him? So three slightly different questions, the first two getting it roughly the same thing, and the last questioning whether we've changed Dele for the worse. But let's start off by doing a sort of historical look back at where things started to go wrong with Dele, and let me put my point to you and see if you remember it in the same way. So I remember Dele starting to drop off in terms of his performance when Pochettino attempted to move him into the central midfield, mainly as a three. And it was when we were trying to sort of work out what we're doing with this Winks and Sissoko midfield partnership, which we all hated. We've said so many times how much we hated that midfield. We still hate it whenever it's turned out today. I think Pochettino tried to get Dele in there to play, again, a hybrid 8-10 role and to try and add something to the midfield defensively, but then also be able to carry the ball forward effectively. And Dele was always at his absolute best when he had complete freedom to move in the final third into spaces where he could create and score goals, mainly score goals, if we're completely honest. He was always been more of somebody on the end of things rather than creating. And then it seemed to me that his confidence took a nosedive as the rest of the team dropped off. So whether he was the symptom or the cause, it's difficult to sort of argue because it all seemed to happen at roughly the same time. And then when Mourinho came in, he was obviously, like, there was the whole Dele's brother situation, and Dele was made the absolute focal point for the early parts of Mourinho's tenure. And he looked really good again then. He looked integral and he was getting goals, he was getting assists. Not at previous rates, but still at good rates. And you could argue that we wouldn't have got the Europa League that season were it not for Dele's interventions. And then whatever happened, he decided that he's not trying enough in training, we think, and he excluded him. Have I got that timeline roughly correct, do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, I think that's more or less where I am. I wrote an article for Statsbomb in the summer of 2019 because we brought in Ndombele and Lo Celso, and I saw a whole load of Spurs fans on Twitter, on Reddit, on forums coming up with their 11 that they were excited to see, and Dele was absent from them, and I thought there was a lack of excitement for Dele. And so I tried to contextualize his performance from the sort of season and a half before, which I accept wasn't great, but he was asked to do a lot more ball carrying and a lot more deeper play, a lot more midfield work, which he could have done better with, to be honest. I think you can tell he's been watching a lot of 1890 Ajax recently. If you look at Van de Beek, who is a player in a very similar profile at the same time, is that he was playing this sort of number 10 who's bursting on behind and running, and then later is asked to play more of a midfield role and adapts to that well and establishes himself as a midfielder, okay, in the Eredivisie, but nonetheless. Whereas Dele, he I don't think the players are positions, but Dele looked like a number 10 trying to do a central midfielder's job, and didn't really grab that by the horns and make himself a controlling, dominating central midfielder who can then also get in the box. So, you know, that's a limitation to his play style. That's a place where I think he was good, but he wasn't at the same level as brilliance in his preferred role. And then, yeah, he sort of had a brief spell at the beginning under Mourinho, and then things have gone downhill since then. I don't want to imply that Dele has been perfect either on the pitch or off the pitch. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make out that he's handled the situation as well as he possibly could. But you've clearly timed these old questions very, very meanly, Windy, because we can now say, well, look at this game and look how much fun he is and look how sharp he looks, even though he's hardly played any football all season. And isn't he a joy to have in the team? And look at what his runs do, even when he doesn't receive the ball. And look at his ability to see the link play, even when he's not receiving the ball behind the lines and all that kind of stuff. And yes, Dele shares some blame for his narrative over the last 2.5 years. Definitely. But his upside is still very present, and that's easy to see against the worst team in the league.
Yeah, and the Mark and Joe know in particular, that wasn't my intention.
Yeah,
and I think Mark and Jonah also have a lot of people who would still be sympathetic to the questions, even now. That's sure. Certainly what I've seen on social media over the last 24 hours. A lot of people are just done with Dele. I mean, Bud, you've sort of hinted to sort of feeling similarly and feeling as though he's still got a lot to prove. So talk us through where you are with him at the moment.
I mean, Dele Alli arrived at our club as an unknown. We didn't know much about him. He was a bit of a punt from Milton Keynes. And he turned out to be this wonderful young player who was... He was a bit of a maverick. He could appear at moments and have decisive impact at games, whether it was a goal or an assist. And his movement caused opposition teams all kinds of problems. But that movement was based upon a platform behind him of like Wanyama, Dembele, Dier, whoever it was, Eriksen, and that kind of trust that he could kind of do what he wanted and just appear and the ball would land at him. He could make that run and Eriksen would curl it in, and at Wembley, Dele would turn it in, and it was a brilliant goal. And we saw that throughout those early seasons, whether it was Alderweireld's ball, once Dier hit a good pass for the first time ever and Dele finished it at Chelsea. And it was this game that was, it was his movement, which was a lot of faith in the team behind him giving him the ball. I think what happened with Dele is the moment when we asked him to go and get the ball and create from deeper, and it's just not his game. I hoped that he would turn into a kind of a box-to-box kind of Pogba player or a Gerrard kind of player who would be able to do that, but he hasn't. So I think injuries has impacted him as well. I think his one-footedness is a problem, although not a terminal problem. But I think we haven't seen him adapt enough and be able to change how he plays to suit circumstances and suit the managers around him. I still have faith in him. I don't know if he will ever be that kind of controlling presence. But then I also worry that he's now 25, and this is going to sound proper football man, maybe even a touch of Graham Souness, but I think now is the time for him to actually establish and figure out who he is, even though he's only 25 years old, he's still a boy. I would like to see him figure out what his role is on the pitch, and then if he's good enough, then the team will kind of build themselves around him. And that's my fear right now, is that Dele's a little bit lost and we're a little bit lost, and we need somebody, a manager that understands him, to bring the best out of him. I thought Jose could do that because, like you said, he was incredible those first early months under Jose. 8 goals he scored that season. But I do think a lack of maybe belief in himself, a lack of identity in how he plays, and his body being injured and suffering more injuries than he ever had before, because before he was just clocking up all the minutes and running around and it didn't affect him. So I do think he's had a little bit of a crisis of identity, and I hope in the next 5 games or so he kind of figures it out.
Yeah, and it'll be nice for him to be given those 5 games to really sort of get back to basics, get back to what he does best.
But there was one thing that you said, Windy, which I'd like to ask you now. So you want to see Ndombele, Dele, Lo Celso and Højbjerg play. So who doesn't play?
Yesterday, I think we could have played Lo Celso and Ndombele in midfield, to be honest. But generally, I would play Højbjerg. I would play always Højbjerg in midfield. Now we're playing 1 game a week. I think you could get away with playing with Lo Celso in a wide position
instead of Bale. So who misses out?
Or Son. I think the key is that I just don't think we need to like pick the same players each time. I think there can be a bit more rotation and bringing players off the bench a bit more. So like I would love to see Ndombele and Højbjerg with Dele in the team. Maybe Lo Celso right or Bale whoever, and then whoever on the left. That really appeals to me. If we could see that for a couple of games, I'd be very happy. But yeah, I mean, I'm not like wedded to the idea of Son starting every game, for example. Like, he's been quite poor in patches recently, probably because he's played every game. So I'm happy for a bit more rotation of the front band of 4.
Hold up.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, following on from our recruitment discussion in the last podcast, Paul Nelson asks which of the players signed by Spurs from the summer 2017 onwards would get into the 2016-17 side. I think what Paul's saying here basically is, look, the recruitment can't be that good because it hasn't improved the team. Nathan, what do you think? I mean, Ndombele is probably a good place to start. Would he get into the 2016-17 side?
Probably, because Dembele's injured half the time, so he gets yeah. in that way. I don't, we've signed good players in that time. We just haven't signed enough good players. We signed a few not great players, and just generally, I think the volume has been too low. You know, I think Ndombele and Lo Celso, there's a lot of still hesitation over Lo Celso, which I think is a shame. I think he's a really good player. But I think Ndombele, Lo Celso are brilliant players. Who else have we signed? Should I bring up a list?
That does include 1 year where we didn't sign anybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the point, though. I think that's yeah. the issue, right? If we'd have signed one or two players on Ndombele, or maybe go as low as Lo Celso's level in 2018, it'd be a very different story, right? If we'd have bought a very good right back, if we'd have bought a very good centre back. I mean, to be honest, I think we did. We bought Foyt, and he's a really special young player, and we didn't develop him under two managers. We failed to make use of his talents. Davinson Sanchez has regressed, but when we bought him, he was at values at 40 million. And I think if we'd have, you know, if you take the concept of 40 million pounds worth of centre back, then that looks a little better than Davinson Sanchez does at the moment, bless
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yes, there are issues in our recruitment. I'm the first to say that. But I think there are also quite a few teams who are worse at recruitment than us. It's just taken a summer off, and that hurting us for several years in a row, because you can't really do that.
That's fair. I think the other obvious player that would have got into that side is Reguilon.
Yes.
At the expense of Ben Davis. Not necessarily of, you know, when Danny Rose was at his best, then sure, that's a difficult player to displace, but Reguilon's clearly better than Ben Davis.
I think he's better than Rose at his best too. I think that will be...
I think he might well be. Yeah, I think that could become apparent over the next couple of years, for sure. I've just realised that we didn't mention the Lo Celso incident.
Oh, yeah. the attempted murder.
And yeah, I mean, I do think it's worth talking about. I was absolutely... When I first saw the replay, I was like, okay, cool, red card, brilliant. This is going to be a goal fest now. And then when nothing happened, I was thinking, like, how could you watch that? As a referee who's refereed many football matches, who has a good understanding of what players are about and what players are trying to do, and seeing the sort of look down at Lo Celso that Fleck has... How could you possibly think that that was an accident? I mean, it was so obviously deliberate. I don't think he was deliberately trying to step on his head. I think he was deliberately trying to step on him. Two referees missed it, essentially. Two referees have decided that this is a nothing incident. To not even send the on-pitch referee to go and have a look at the monitor and judge for himself just seemed balmy to me. And I hope it gets reviewed. I hope that Fleck gets retrospectively banned. I hope the video assistant referee for this match sits out a couple of games, because apparently he was the same one who did flag up the Balbuena challenge, which was literally a follow-through from a clearance. Yeah. You know, so madness, absolute madness. Buddy, you're
a fan of violence.
You're less sensitive to the... Yeah, you're, well, you are a fan of violence. You're less sensitive to these things than me, but how bad did that look to you?
No, it's a ridiculous decision not to send him off. If you think Son got sent off for what he did for Rudiger.
Right.
And as you mentioned, the Balbuena incident, I don't understand why it hasn't been flagged, why you don't review it. I think Mason was quite right to get upset about it. I don't understand what's the point of VAR sometimes. I'm all for the idea of VAR, but this is just... is one of those reasons that you look at and you think, yeah, there's something going really wrong with the game.
Completely. And look, VAR, the system can make some tackles look worse because you're watching mm-hmm. them in super, super slow-mo. And I have some sympathy with that takeaway. But this is someone who's deliberately trying to injure an opponent, inflict pain on an opponent. This isn't like a mistimed tackle. This isn't someone you know, accidentally going a little bit high up on the shin or the ankle because their follow-through is happening that way. This is someone trying to tread on someone and he ends up treading on his head, on his temple. You know, it's a really sensitive part of the skull. He could have done some severe damage. I was absolutely staggered that that wasn't deemed a red card. Honestly, staggered. Anyway, there you go. There's my outrage at the incident. And do you know what else as well?
Go on, Wendy, go on. You've got the floor now.
Andy Hinchcliffe laughing about the massive ice pack on Lo Celso's head. You know, like, it's not fun. Like, that's not funny. That's as a result of a really terrible challenge, which could have done some significant damage to him.
Could have blinded him.
Our manager had his career ended by a head injury.
It's true. Could have blinded him.
He could have blinded him. You're absolutely right. You know, just.
We should make footballers wear goggles or helmets.
I don't often get irate about this kind of stuff, but honestly, there's such a lack of protection there that just winds me up. And it's so simple to fix
as well. I think that's the thing. Because whenever there is like a discussion around a decision that is sort of ascribing intent, yes, I think if you watch that footage, it's pretty easy to be persuaded that it was a deliberate move. But as long as you have the possibility to be like not absolutely certain, the referees are always going to have the decision or the opportunity to give Flick the benefit of the doubt, you know? And then they can justify that backwards and say, well, he's, you know, he's a nice guy and all of that kind of stuff. And this is why I'm pretty sure the rules as written don't actually worry too much about deliverance. And then it's really what that should be judged on is whether his action was dangerous. This is when you get into discussion about, like, is Balbuena clearing the ball dangerous if there's a player near him when he does it and that kind of thing. But yeah, if we return to, like, why do referees exist? What are the rules for? And all that kind of stuff. The point is to protect the players. And it's not unfair to say that Flick has put himself in a situation, at the very least, where he's landing on another player's studs down and you work from there and you just say, okay, maybe that wasn't quite as deliberate as it looks, but look at his face. Look what you've done to his face. So, yeah, I appreciate your frustration.
And Lo Celso doesn't help himself because he kind of reacted in the same way that he reacts to literally every challenge on him.
Those bloody lines.
Yeah. Very Latin. Very Latin. So this question sort of harks back to something I was suggesting at the start of the podcast. Alec Deprinsky says, is there anyone you would like to see get a run of games before deciding if it needs to be sold in the summer? Conversely, who are you already on board with selling? So we've spoken quite a bit before about who we are up for selling. I think we kind of want to sell half the squad. But Bardi, this made me think of Harry Winks. Are you keen to see a bit of Winks in a more possession-based team just to sort of get a gauge of where he is now as a player before deciding whether to move him on or not?
I don't think we're going to learn anything new about Harry Winks now. I think he is what he is. I don't think he's going to improve. I don't think he's going to get any worse. I think he's got a very solid football career in front of him. I just don't think that career will be at Tottenham.
What sort of level of club do you think he'll end up at?
I think he'll do all right at I think he'll do all right at Palace. He'll be okay there.
I think he's a little better than Palace. I think he's more of a mid-tabler.
The Palace are mid-table, no?
They're in a false position. They're a fake mid-table. They are playing some of the most horrific football to watch. Mm. Like Spurs fans, we've had it nice compared to what Palace. And yeah, they've got results, but God, that's not suited to Harry Winks at all.
I mean, I do give a little, every now and then, I don't mind Palace, Not because I don't, yeah, I don't mind them. They got some proper trash in their team.
They do. They've
got, Hodgson keeps them up, and I have a soft spot for Hodgson. So, I always admire what he's able to do. And the fact that the moment he leaves Palace, they're done. They're going to get relegated. So I think that's kind of why they're not rebelling against him.
I wonder whether he might be a target for someone like Wolves. That seems to me to be a fairly good fit. Pairing with Ruben Neves in midfield, that's a pretty decent possession-based midfield. Southampton would be reasonable, or even Brighton.
Yeah.
Give them give Brighton wings, we take Potter.
Yeah,
and Lamptey and Ben White and et cetera, et cetera. Any other players, Nathan, that you'd like to see get a run before deciding what to do with them in the summer, or do you already know enough?
I think we kind of know enough, to be honest. I don't see us changing our mind about Bergwijn or Lamella or Lucas, you know. That's really a matter to come back to probably in January, you know, based on how the next manager feels or uses the players he has at his disposal. Like, there's no one who we brought in that, like, hasn't seen that much football. I guess Bergwijn is the only one. But, like, I admit, personally, I feel I have a good read on Bergwijn. Maybe Spurs don't, maybe Spurs fans don't. But, like, he's a talented young player who needs some game time. He's a much more decisive, dynamic final third player than he has appeared, and you want to see that appear for him in the near future. But his build up play and his holding up play and his defensive work has been perfectly good and strong and fine for us. So it's not like we're going, oh, who's this dud that we've bought? I thought he was meant to be good. He's just, you know, it's just not gone well for him. I don't know. I again, as I mentioned earlier, like, the jury's still out for a lot of people on Lo Celso, but we're not going to be making a decision on him over the next couple of games. So I don't know who would be. I guess Doherty. I guess Doherty is the player who, like, you, but you're not going to, why are you going to bench Aurier just to get a feel for Doherty at this stage, you know? Maybe he gets one or two of the next games, but it's got to come down to the next manager. I think my personal strategy at right back, I think, would probably be to sell Serge Aurier and bring in a right back who is going to keep Doherty on the bench pretty solidly, while you then work out what you're going to do with him if he plays a couple of cup games next season, and if he looks rough again, then you have to move on from Doherty. Who I can't think of. Gazzaniga, like,
he's on loan. You can't play alone. I mean, the only other one that is probably worth discussing is Eric Dier, because there have been times this season where we've been absolutely adamant that Dier should and will be sold come the summer. And now we're watching him in a team that doesn't defend so much and has more of the ball, and he moves it pretty well. He's, you know, he did misplace a pass quite badly yesterday against Sheffield United, but on the whole, he does move the ball pretty well. He's got reasonable technical ability. He gets it into his feet and back out and moves it on pretty nicely, and suddenly seems a lot better suited to being a centre-back, just because the system's more favourable for him. Personally speaking, I would try and sell Dier still. I think we can do better than Eric Dier. I think we have got better than Eric Dier, to be honest. I think already Rodon and Tanganga are my preferences over Eric Dier. But he obviously brings something which successive managers have liked. I think it's probably in terms of his mental attributes and his organisational attributes. But yeah, Bardi, Dier, he's still in the Dier out camp.
I don't think he serves any purpose for us. He's not even counted as homegrown. Get rid of him.
Absolutely savage. Let's do one more before we wrap up. Set pieces. So this is something that's been bubbling away for a little while. Harry Kane and his blooming free kicks. So Adam Moore emailed us and he sent us a video, which is really interesting, of Harry Kane talking to Thierry Henry on Sky Sports. I think it might have been Soccer AM. I can't quite remember. I watched it a while back now. And Adam's point was, when I first saw this, you could see the question sink into Harry's brain about taking more free kicks. I'm sure there's more to it, but I always think of that conversation when he blasts one off the wall. And Henry was basically like saying, you can add 10 more goals by becoming a master of free kicks, which is completely like outrageously unreasonable for a start. But like, it does ring true that this was, watching that video made me go, shit, yeah, maybe that's the starting point. Nathan, why does Harry Kane still take free kicks?
who else is going to take him?
Gareth Bale?
He's only good at free kicks from a medium distance and when the ball is over towards the right-hand side of the pitch.
Giovanni Lo Celso?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Be better, wouldn't it?
Reguilon?
Well, maybe. I have no idea.
Aurier?
I mean...
Eric Dier?
Yes, actually, Eric Dier's a good shout. I forget about that. Yeah.
I just think Kane's free kicks are so poor.
Well, they're poor because we know how well Harry Kane can strike a ball when it's, you know, got a bit of movement on it. They're poor because when you see Harry Kane approach a ball in open play, you're confident. And then you feel the exact opposite way when he's taking a free kick. Free kicks aren't, direct free kicks aren't a very fruitful, generally a very fruitful path to victory, sure. You know.
Unless you're James Ward-Prowse.
Unless, yeah. And everybody, all professional players should be like putting in 3 hours a week on looking at James Ward-Prowse videos and working on that specific technique. But there you go. That's a whole different thing. Until the Ward-Prowse revolution is upon us. Direct free kicks in the rest of world football aren't a very fruitful way of scoring, so it's not a huge deal. And it does very much feel like, with the sort of the Cristiano Ronaldo thing, that it's like this is part of his this is part of his contract, right? He gets 200k a week and he gets to take the free kicks and he gets to smack them all into the wall.
Do you think that might be it?
No, I don't think it's actually written in. What I'm saying is that his personality and his position within the team and his place as the talisman demands that if he wants to take the free kicks, he gets to take the free kicks. Now, maybe a new manager comes in and he says, no, I'm going to take control of the situation and I will assign the free kick taker. But I think as long as it is down to the players on the pitch, Harry Kane gets to, because the captain is Hugo Lloris, right? So there's no one to tell him off. There's no one to say no. You know, Lloris is down the other end having a nice sit down. I don't know. I don't care that much because I don't care that much about direct free kicks. And I don't think that, like, our free kick taker used to be Ericsson. When he was first at Spurs, he had an incredible run of free kicks, and then they suddenly dried up because that is the reality of free kicks. You take a great free kick taker, and he will go 3 years without scoring from one because that's just how they work. So I'm not like, we need Lo Celso's an incredible. We've got to be using Lo Celso. We've got to be using Eric Dier because he's scored like two, and that makes him the best free kick taker at the club. You know, one of those for England. It's whatever. It doesn't upset me that much. I don't mind it being, you know, part of the Harry Kane tribute to keep Harry Kane. You know, if it keeps him at the club, he can take all the free kicks he wants. He can take goal kicks.
What we need to do is hire James Ward-Prowse as a set piece coach.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, free kicks is such. It's such a low percentage scoring rate. Like Messi's at like 12% success rate. The guy with the most direct free kicks in Premier League history is Beckham, and he scored one every 1,200 minutes. This is not something I remember off the top of my head, but something that I've looked up. So Beckham scored one every 13 games. So that's not prolific, and he's the greatest ever. Ward-Prowse has got 8, and Ward-Prowse scores one every 1,835 minutes. So it's not like Harry Kane is deliberately denying people goals because he's taking our free kicks. I think in terms of hitting the ball technique, he's one of the best. So why not give him the strike when it's 30 yards out? It's when it's a little bit closer to home that I think you need a little bit more guile to get it up and down. Yeah. Someone like Zola, Henri, those kind of guys. Sebastian Larsson is up on that list as well. I don't have a problem with, like, Eriksen. We talked about Eriksen. He scored 8 and he scored one every 2,289 minutes. I don't have a problem with Harry Kane whacking a free kick from distance. I do have a problem when it's a little bit close in and, you know, he's not really got the guile to do that. So if he wants to keep him taking free kicks means he stays at the club another season, then let him take all the free kicks. I do have a problem with him taking corners, though.
So on to corners, because this is related. And I thought this was a really interesting question from Josh from Milton Keynes, who says, I remember hearing that the new stadium has one of the shortest run-ups to the corner flag. It looks roughly 2 steps with a sharp ramp downwards. Do you think this negatively affects our ability to put decent balls in from corner positions? Watching both Son and Giovanni Lo Celso against Sheffield United, it looks uncomfortable for them and they didn't seem to put in many good crosses in.
I'm going to call bullshit on that one because we scored a good goal against Arsenal from a corner. We scored a goal against Leeds from a corner. We have scored goals from corners. We've conceded goals from corners at our stadium as well. So I don't think the run-up has any problem with it. I remember Man United always had a very narrow narrow place, and you know, I don't think it's affected them.
I am pretty sympathetic to this argument, actually. I think there isn't a good enough run-up. I think that that it's too steep and too early before the corner. I also think it's kind of a little bit dangerous that if you start off the pitch, not as bad as it is at Old Trafford, because my goodness, they have a death trap surrounding the pitch with the spaces, but it's very easy to slide off into a ditch. And yeah, I do think it affects the run-up, that you don't have much room, that you're coming in at an uphill angle. I don't know, I'd be interested what players might have to say about the pitch.
Well, I was thinking it would be quite easy to look back at some footage of home corners against away corners and see if there's any change in run-up styles. Hmm. Maybe worth a look. I really liked the question. It's not something I thought about before, but it makes sense.
Windy telling Nathan what to do live on air.
Well, I mean, technically I have the same access that Nathan does, so I should just set this as an assignment for myself, shouldn't I?
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.